Hello, and welcome to another episode of Famous Failures, where I interview the world's most interesting people about the failures they've had in their lives and what they learned from them. I'm your host, Ozan Morol. Before I introduce today's guest, I have a request from you. The podcast is fairly new, so I would really appreciate your help in spreading the word. You can do that in one of three ways. You can tell your friends about the podcast, you can subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform that you're listening on, or you can leave a review on iTunes or Google Play. In addition, if you'd like to keep in touch with me and say hello to me, you can subscribe to my weekly newsletter, The Weekly Contrarian. It has thousands of subscribers, and readers call it the one email I look forward to each week. So every Thursday, you'll get a list of tools, articles, books, and other gems that challenge conventional wisdom and change the way that you look at the world. You can sign up for that by going to my website, ozanmorol.com, or texting my first name, Ozan, O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. And if you sign up now, you'll also get a free ebook called The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles for Innovating Your Thinking. And again, you can get that right now on the go by texting O-Z-A-N to 345-345 or heading over to my website, ozanmorol.com. Today's guest on Famous Failures is Srinivas Rao. Srini is a best-selling author and the host of the wildly successful Unmistakable Creative podcast, where his guests range from Olympic athletes to bank robbers to trailblazing entrepreneurs. He self-published his first book, which was called The Art of Being Unmistakable. It went on to become a Wall Street Journal bestseller. His latest book is called Unmistakable: Why Only Is Better Than Best. In my interview with Srini, you'll learn how an early failure launched his successful career as an author and speaker, how his Facebook status updates, of all things, eventually turned into a best-selling book. He talks about why modeling yourself after accomplished people can actually lead to failure. And finally, he discusses how writing 1,000 words a day can change your life. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Srinivas Rao.
So what's been a failure in your life that caused you to move 2 steps back, but then eventually led to 20 steps forward?
Well, I think the one that really probably is most relevant to that question is, you know, how I ended up, you know, with Unmistakable Creative and then a career as an author and a speaker. You know, I went to business school. I applied to business school in 2006. I got rejected from every school I applied to. And in a last ditch effort, I applied to Pepperdine, which, you know, I mean, if you look at just pure rankings and then statistics, is a second tier business school. Like, there's no, you know, no arguing that fact. It's not a Harvard. It's not a Wharton. The caliber of people who come there is a bit different. You know, they're not the sort of type A overachiever valedictorian of their class. And it was a pretty drastic contrast from being a Berkeley undergrad, where I was surrounded by, you know, incredibly ambitious people. In fact, most of my Berkeley friends went to very prestigious schools for graduate school, med school, law school. You know, I mean, the average person in my group of friends, like one of my best friends is a Harvard neurosurgeon resident. So that should give you some context of the average sort of Berkeley grad. So, you know, ending up at Pepperdine in and of itself felt like a pretty massive failure, because I thought, oh, wow, you know, like, this is a real step down. What ended up happening is I graduated from Pepperdine in April 2009. And the summer between my first and second year, I had been the social media intern at Intuit. But as you might imagine, being somebody who's a college professor, you know, no matter who you were, getting out of any educational institution in April of 2009 was a pretty rough go. It was bad. I mean, everybody was really kind of dreading the end of grad school. You know, we didn't want it to end because we knew what we were going to be faced with was nothing. There was literally nothing on the horizon. You know, many of my classmates didn't have jobs when they graduated. A very small percentage of our class did. And it was interesting because Mark Burnett, the creator of Survivor, was our commencement speaker. We thought, how fitting, because we're about to experience a real world version of Survivor. And I think the thing that's interesting there is that had that not happened, I wouldn't have started the first blog that I started. That wouldn't have led to the podcast. That wouldn't have eventually led to this career as an author speaker. And if you told me that this is what was going to happen 9 years ago, I would not have really, you know, said, okay, this is, you know, like a failure that's going to catapult me 20 steps forward. But, you know, I think that is probably the most exemplary thing I can think of in my life, where, you know, business school appeared to be a step back and not having a job was another step back. But 9 years later, here we are, 20 steps forward.
Yeah, and it's really hard to see that as you're going through it, because in the moment it feels like a complete failure. But as right. Steve Jobs said in his like commencement speech, the life connects the dots for you later on.
It's funny because, you know, there's a sort of lightness that comes with being that in that strangely of a dark place, because you have nothing, like, right? I literally was like, okay, well, there's no job on the table, you know, like trying to figure out what to do next with my life is kind of like, there's no option here. Like, there's no options in front of me, and I have to kind of create them at this point. And so I think it allowed me to see possibility when in the past, all I would have seen were options.
Sure. Absolutely. I'd love to hear a little bit more about how you started the blog and then the podcast. In the book, yes. You talk about you started the podcast in 2010, but you mentioned mm-hmm. that it didn't become truly unmistakable until 2014. So I'd love to hear yeah. about the roadblocks that you experienced in that interim four-year period and how you overcame them.
In that summer, after graduate school had finished, I joined an online course called Blog Mastermind that was created by a guy named Yara Stark. And you know, I think the interesting thing is online courses can be highly effective if you actually do them, but so few people actually complete them. The statistics are staggering. Like, I remember Yara told me when I interviewed him, he said, you know, what happens is you get a percentage of people who buy the course and never do anything, like a significant percentage who spend the money and don't ever open it, which is crazy. And even Tony Robbins has talked about this in his personal power program. Like, people buy this thing and they don't use it. Then you get a percentage of people who will take some action. They start out very excited. And, you know, those group of people wears off. And then you get a percentage of people who actually get a result. And so by the time you whittle it down, you've got a percent of a percent of a percent who's actually getting a result from this. But if you want to be in that sort of percent of a percent of a percent, the really simple secret is to actually do the material in the online course, to complete it, to do it at a pace that's reasonable. Because I think that's the other thing, is that most people try to bite off more than they can chew. And the structure of the course somehow really worked well for me because of the fact that I had all this time, and you know, because I didn't pay for the course up front, I was only getting one lesson a week. And every week it was a lesson that took 10 minutes to implement. It was like, install this plugin on your blog or install WordPress. So bit by bit, after about 13 weeks, I think the 13th week interview, a lesson was to interview somebody. And so I reached out to somebody and this guy ended up being my first interview. And it was very sort of prophetic for him to say it. I don't know why he said it, but he said, don't underestimate what this is going to do for you. You know, I didn't make much of it at the time, but I said, okay, well, who else should I interview? And he referred me to another blogger. So it started out as interviews with up and coming bloggers. Then it became, after about 13 interviews, Blogcast FM, where the focus was still interviews with bloggers, but it was no longer up and coming bloggers. It was the sort of podcast where everybody who had a blog came and talked about their blog. And over the course of, you know, that was 2010. So over the course of the next 3 years, the content started to morph a lot. The questions started to change. And I stopped being as interested in learning about, you know, business tactics, which was beginning to be very mind-numbing about, you know, how did you increase your traffic or how did you do this and that? And I started to get much more interested in people's stories, like who they were as people, because that was just so much more fascinating. And then around 2013, I had a mentor who came to work with me, with somebody I'd interviewed, a guy named Greg Hartle. And Greg kind of took me under his wing and he said, you know, I think that you've built this really incredible body of work, but I don't think it has a brand identity. And I think it's not going to survive if we don't make a major change. You know, he's like, I'm asking you to trust me with something that you've spent 4 years working on. So I get that that's hard. So and coincidentally, right around the same time, I had been doing a very sort of different style of writing with these like ridiculously long Facebook status updates where I was talking about just thoughts that were on my mind. And, you know, and those ridiculously long Facebook status updates became the foundation for my self-published book, The Art of Being Unmistakable. And what's interesting is that that book, through just a number of bizarre coincidences, ended up in the hands of Glenn Beck, ended up in the Glenn Beck Show, sold 15,000 copies, became a Wall Street Journal bestseller. All the meanwhile, we're trying to figure out how to rebrand, you know, our show. We wrote a book called The Art of Being Unmistakable. And after about 100 names, we were kind of like, what do we call it? We said, and my probably one of his greatest contributions was the brand. Greg Hartle said, Unmistakable Creative. I was like, that's it. That's the one. I'm like, he sent me hundreds of names and I hated all of them. And I said, you know, it's one of those things where you just kind of know. And he said, okay, great. He said, buy the domain. And so we bought the domain and then we began the entire sort of rebrand process. And you know, like in the rebrand process, I think is where we started to really uncover this idea of unmistakable, of basically creating a very distinctive sort of look and feel on the web. But it went beyond a distinctive look and feel. It was kind of like, let's ignore what everybody else is doing and do something that, you know, really stands out. And so we went from this very sort of cookie cutter podcast website called Blogcast FM to this highly visually engaging website called Unmistakable Creative. And you know, all the people who thought we were crazy to change our names, every one of them was like, oh my God, this is brilliant. Like, you know, what you guys have done is so smart. And, you know, with that, of course, came a change in the direction of the content as well. So we went from being the podcast for bloggers to our show is really a show about candid conversations with insanely interesting people. And you know, the idea of Unmistakable Creative was all encompassing. So we could interview entrepreneurs, we could interview social scientists, we could interview people who just have weird stories, like the guy who robbed 30 banks in 14 months. Suddenly you had a much more expansive sense of possibility with what could be done with this. And that, I think, is really kind of what brought us to Unmistakable. And then, of course, you know, as a listener, you know, like, we profile probably one of the widest range of guests of any podcast that's out there. And, you know, our guests are quite diverse. I think the one thing we pride ourselves on is the fact that we know when you show up at our show, you're going to hear people you haven't heard anywhere else.
Sure. That's a really inspiring story, because I think the tendency, regardless of the industry you're in, is to sort of look over the shoulders of your competitors and figure out what everybody else is doing and then emulate them, right? But the center, as you said, is too crowded. It's only when you sort of, you know, go to the edges and embrace your distinctive qualities that you became, as you call it, Unmistakable.
Precisely. Yeah, that's absolutely true. Yeah. And the thing is, that's such a hard thing for people to get their heads around, right? Because what do? We look at mentors, we look at people who've accomplished things, like, okay, I want to do exactly what that person did. So if I do exactly what that person did, I will get the result that they've gotten, which fails to take into account one very, very big variable. If you look at it as an equation, and that variable is you, that we completely take out the very thing that would make us unmistakable, which is ourselves, when we do that.
Absolutely. So you mentioned you self-published a book that got the attention of Glenn Beck, and then you eventually moved to the traditional publishing route. Yeah. I'd love to hear a little bit more about that transition and what roadblocks you experienced along the way.
So, you know, interestingly enough, so the self-published book did really well. And, we had this just sort of crazy momentum behind it. And, you know, we ended up planning a live event right after. We sold out a 60-person two-day conference. The funny thing is that spotlight kind of just faded. You know, you realized after a certain point that, okay, this isn't going to last forever, right? Like, you feel, I think, when things are going really well, that it's going to last forever. This is, you know, my friend Kamal's quote. He said, when things are going really well, it feels like it's going to last forever. And when things are going terrible, it feels like it's never going to end. And so we went from sort of the heights of success to really, you know, me having a lot of personal challenges in my life, dealing with a severe anxiety and depression, and you know, nearly running the business into the ground by the end of 2014. But what's interesting is that the success of the self-published book caught the attention of an editor at Penguin who didn't find me. So I wrote a piece on Medium titled How Writing 1,000 Words a Day Changed My Life. That piece ended up going viral on Medium, but it went viral in 2013 and it was still being viewed. And when my editor, Stephanie, came back to Penguin, it was one of the first things that she saw. She started scouring Medium and she landed on that post and Unmistakable Creative. And she sent me an email saying, hey, Srini, I love what you're doing. Have you ever thought about doing a traditionally published book? I'd love to talk because you're at the top of my list to do a book with. And so in a lot of ways, it was kind of like this Cinderella. In a way, it's a Cinderella story that I got like sort of picked. But, you know, again, the non-Cinderella part of that story is it took 7 years, you know? So you can kind of say, okay, yeah, I got lucky. And you know, I am absolutely aware of the fact that that was an incredible amount of luck. Like I didn't have to court a publisher and it's a very different feeling when somebody is courting you. And you know, I'm eternally grateful for that. Like it was a golden opportunity. And so, you know, what I would say is that, you know, it didn't come easily. I still had to work. And the funny thing is that maybe this is the more important lesson. You know, you may have come across this piece that I just did titled The 7 Hard Truths About Building a Creative Career. I think that people who have not had this experience in their minds, they see it, and I sure as hell did. So, you know, I'd imagine it's not an uncommon experience. They see it as this sort of moment of arrival when suddenly the work stops and everything gets easier. And what's funny is that you have this moment and what you realize in that moment is that the work is just beginning, that now the stakes are so much higher, the pressure is on in a different way, and you really want to deliver for the people that have bet on you. You know, like suddenly it's no longer just about you, it's about a lot of other people, you know, editors, agents, you know, publishers, like all these people have bet on you and you don't want to let them down, you know, and like I realized that as a public figure who works, you know, with a team of two or three other people and has, you know, all these other people, like my actions are no longer just about me. Like they have implications for everybody that is connected to me in any way at all. You know, like what I say is, so if you think about it, right, who's associated with our brand? Like Mars Dorian is associated with our brand. So, you know, anything I say in essence is also, you know, not in like a, I guess it really in essence is like my actions impact other people now. And that's what happens when you get to this moment is that you really don't have the luxury of, you know, going off the deep end over anything because so many people are counting on you.
Sure. Yeah, that's really interesting. So it sounds like in the beginning, when you're first developing your brand and your platform, it's almost more about you a little bit because you're interested in growing traffic to your site and whatnot. But at a certain point, and this may have been 7-8 years for you, the perspective shifts almost, right? When you're saying you feel a responsibility towards the people that you work with and your audience because they're expecting from you.
Yeah, I mean, audience as well. You know, audience is a big one. You know, it's a really interesting thing because you go from, you know, an audience of 0 to 100 to audience of thousands. And you, in a lot of ways, have to be very mindful of the fact that, okay, these people have given me their attention and energy. It's on me to deliver what they're expecting, not to you know, mail it in or to show up and give you lousy work. And again, and you know, there are people who are not going to like what you've done. That's always there. Like some people don't like our show. And I'm like, that's great. It's not for you. And, you know, my job is not to try to please them or change anything. But yeah, I think that's absolutely true.
So you're a prolific writer, as you pointed out. You have that that Medium post that went viral about how you wrote 1,000 words a day and how that changed your life. How do you fail when it comes to writing?
How do you fail when it comes to writing? Well, I fail every day when it comes to writing, right? I think we have to look at is, you know, how do you define failing? And to me, you know, like one, to me, to not write would be failure. So I don't really fail, I guess I could say. But the reality is that what I realized, you know, rather quickly, where the 1,000 words came from was Julian Smith. And Julian Smith had one of the most popular blogs on the internet at the time. And I thought to myself, okay, this guy built one of the most popular blogs on the internet, be something to this writing 1,000 words a day. And he's done it religiously. He still does, to the best of my knowledge. And he's the CEO of a startup called Breather now. But, you know, he had a very unique and distinctive writing style. Like his voice was clear. Like he's co-written books with Chris Brogan, and you can actually spot the parts that, you know, Julian's written. Julian's voice is incredibly distinctive. And I actually think it has to do with, you know, sort of the way he chooses to, you know, maintain that habit as well as his reading choices. So he has this very unique voice. So that struck me. And so I did it. I think really you come at it every day knowing that, okay, you know what, like every day you fail in some way because a good amount of what you write is lousy. You know, like, but the thing is, when you're doing it every day, you don't need that much of it to be good. And that's incredibly liberating.
Yeah. As Seth Godin says, a small thing repeated is not a small thing. So, well, you know, 1,000 words a day just quickly ends up.
Well, and you know, like Adam Grant actually, you know, discovered this in his book Originals. He said the most creative people were the ones who created the highest volume. He said, you know, volume, it turns out, it was your cumulative output that mattered more than any individual thing that you did.
It's almost like you need to get some of that junk out of your system for the gems to emerge to the surface.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What do you think was it about the post that made it so appealing? I mean, aside from the content, did you do anything to get the word out about what you were writing?
Not really. I mean, it was one, I think I was an early reading medium, so that probably helped. You know, I was making a presence. I think that it was a provocative title. And then the other thing is, it wasn't just a provocative title. It was incredibly in-depth. Like I wrote about how I actually did this and how I went about it and what ended up happening. You know, I mean, so that post, you know, it led to not only to Glenn Beck, but also a substantial advance in a two book deal with Penguin. And so it's interesting because that habit, you know, still continues and does change my life. But as far as the post, I don't think I did anything in particular other than write a very honest and in-depth piece. I mean, I think that one of the things that we've started to notice is that, you know, when we do really in-depth content, it tends to resonate, especially in a world of short attention spans and people not writing long stuff. Like long form is kind of losing in some way, but then you go look at the stuff that goes crazy viral or does really big. It just tends to be the longer, more in-depth stuff.
Right. And sort of going back to what we were talking about earlier too, the shorter stuff tends to be what everybody else is doing. And so
longer stuff takes work in depth. Longer stuff is deep work.
Absolutely.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for listening. Two things before you take off. First, if you don't want to miss out on future episodes of Famous Failures, Please subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you're listening on, and be sure to leave a review on iTunes or Google Play. Second, if you'd like to join thousands of others who receive a short email from me each Thursday with a list of articles, books, tools, quotes, and other gems that help you discover how extraordinary thinking produces extraordinary results, you can text my first name, which is Ozan, that's spelled O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. So once again, that's my first name, Ozan, O-Z-A-N, to 345-345. Or if you're in front of your computer, you can head over to ozanvarol.com and drop your email address. If you act now, you'll also get a free ebook called The Contrarian Handbook, 8 Principles to Innovate Your Thinking. As always, thank you for listening and see you next time.